Welcome to Southern Living on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Leslie Hunt, and I will be reading from the May issue of Southern Living magazines. The focus on articles for this week is spring, holidays, decorating, barbecue, and of course, food. So if you're ready, let's get going. Our first article is entitled, When Did Charlotte Become a Food Town? This was written by Tara Mosula McKay, is found in the section entitled The South Long Weekend. When you're thinking about North Carolina vacation destinations, Charlotte may not be the first to come to mind. You might start by considering the mountain capital of Asheville. The Outer Banks' charming coastal hamlets could beckon. And the Research Triangle would probably pique your interest, too. Despite being the state's most populated and most visited city, Charlotte doesn't often top people's travel bucket lists. But lately, that sentiment has begun to change, and the flourishing food scene here is largely to thank. Charlotte has long been known as a place of industry. It was once a textile town, and you can still see remnants of its manufacturing heyday in the many converted mills that now bring restaurants, coffee shops, and boutique shopping under one roof. At the turn of the 21st century, Bank of America made its move here. Troost and Wells Fargo followed, and today Charlotte is the second largest banking hub in the United States. As a result, the city has sometimes been typecast as a boring financial bro with catatonic cuisine to match, a place with too many steakhouses and little else to hang its culinary hat on. This March, a new season of Top Chef debuted, starring Charlotte as one of the host cities. In two decades on air, the Emmy Award-winning cooking competition has built a reputation for spotlighting great food destinations. Season 23's jaunt in the Carolinas couldn't have come at a more apt time. In late 2025, Charlotte made a splash with 11 restaurants receiving recognition in the Michelin Guide to the American South, including one that earned a star. A couple of months later, the James Beard Foundation named one of its locals a semifinalist for Best Chef Southeast. All that buzz, plus a list of new openings that topped 100 in 2025 alone, was reason enough for us to revisit the Queen City and rediscover all it has to offer when it comes to food. A long time coming. Like anything that's worth its salt, Charlotte's restaurant boom didn't occur overnight. It was more of a slow burn. In 1999, when Bruce Moffat, a New England transplant, opened a bistro named for his hometown of Barrington, Rhode Island, the going was hard. There were mostly steakhouses and cafeterias as dining options. I opened the restaurant to a skeptical crowd that didn't understand why I wasn't offering the same menu as the rest of the places in town, he says about Barrington's. The first few months were difficult, and it was slow to gain its footing. Eventually, over the next few years, our reputation grew, and we found the people that appreciated what we did. By the time he launched his second spot, Good Food on Montford, in 2009, the culinary climate had heated up. The tide was turning downtown, too. 2 years before, Charlotte had installed a light rail system connecting the south side of I-48-5 to Uptown. Suddenly, folks began streaming in on the weekends, and not just for the Panthers games. In the nearly two decades since, the light rail and Moffitt's reach have both spread dramatically. The Link's Blue Line now extends all the way to the University of North Carolina, Charlotte's campus, with 26 stations and 10 park-and-ride locations. Moffitt's restaurant group has multiplied with Italian eatery Stagione, its sister cocktail bar Sala, and a ramen and bun shop called Bao and Broth. Around the same time, Good Food on Montford debuted a pair of other young restaurateurs was just getting started. On the heels of an eight-month around-the-world trip, Jamie Brown and Jeff Tony Dondel returned to Charlotte and took on their biggest adventure yet. While we were gone, we talked about this really fun idea to open a restaurant, Brown recalls. When we came back, it was 2008, the recession had hit, and that was a terrible idea. Jeff took me to dinner one night and said, I decided what I want to do. I want to start that restaurant that we talked about. 9 months later, their goal was realized in the form of a crepe shop in the burgeoning Noda neighborhood. Today, their restaurant group includes 3 Michelin-recommended spots, Supperland, Haberdish, and Ever Andalo, plus a donut window and a beer bar. Their newest endeavor, Leluia Hall, a bright and airy surf and turf place in a historic former church, opened a year ago this month. The food is elegant yet playful with impeccable attention to detail. Teensy two-bite homemade tortillas are filled with lobster or yellowtail. The ceviche is made with acidified pineapple juice. Probably their most popular of the bunch, Superland is a, quote, southern steakhouse meets church potluck, end quote, that's located in a mid-century building that once served as a sanctuary. Inside the expansive dining room, guests pass around family-style plates of pot roast, mac and cheese, and corn salad. It's just like Grandma used to make, only the roast is Wagyu beef, the mac and cheese includes miso, and the corn salad is complemented by chimichurri and garlic aioli. Don't miss their done-up version of ambrosia salad or the glazed Covington sweet potato, which may be the best take on the southern spud you'll ever eat. Forget about the marshmallow versus pecan topping debate. This one is baked over coals and served with tamarind, hot honey, whipped butter, and savory cashew ice cream. Key to the community. There's no faster way to foster togetherness than by breaking bread, and there are several spots around town where that's abundantly clear. At Long Van, an unassuming Vietnamese restaurant in the Plaza Shamrock neighborhood, the walls are covered with Christmas cards and thank you notes. Most customers don't leave without a hug and I love you, especially from Dan Nguyen, who has owned the spot alongside her husband since 2009. The menu is extensive, offering vermicelli and pho, plus less common dishes such as Vietnamese hot pot and lemongrass marinated tofu. Not sure what to order? Ask the patrons next to you. They're likely regulars who will be more than happy to rhapsodize about their favorites. Back towards Center City, in the shadow of Bank America Stadium, is another establishment with people at its heart. Community Matters Cafe is an offshoot of the Charlotte Rescue Mission, a long-standing residential drug and alcohol recovery program. Graduates can continue their growth by working at the restaurant, earning practical skills in everything from hosting to cooking. At its helm is executive chef Chaelil Johnson, the native of La Place, Louisiana, and graduate of Johnson and Wales University, says he was well on his way climbing the fine dining ladder when he realized God had other plans. That was the most impulsive thing I've ever done, he remembers. It was the first time in my life when I was like, God really wants me to be here and do this. When he took over Community Matters Kitchen at the age of 23, he had already almost a decade of kitchen experience thanks to his unique high school education in the Emeril Lagasse-backed culinary program at the New Orleans Center for Creative Arts, and was more than ready to revamp the menu. The cafe roasts its coffee beans on site and excels at classics, including French toast and egg sandwiches. Dishes like oxtail, sweet potato casserole with chermoula braised oxtail, sorghum sweet potato mash, nut dunka, an Egyptian nut and spice condiment, and collard fiscalis, a spicy Haitian slaw, let Johnson's unique point of view shine. When he was named a James Beard Award semifinalist for Best Chef Southeast in 2025, it was the accumulation of 2 dreams, one old and the other new. When I came here, I kind of gave that up, he says. I thought there's no way I'm going to get a James Beard with the food that we're doing and the environment this is. But I think the best part was seeing the excitement from the students because now everyone who works here gets to say they worked at a James Beard recognized restaurant. They have so much pride in that, which was so powerful to me. Another point of community pride is Manolo's Bakery, the city's first Latino bake shop, which got its start as Las Delicias in 1997. Go for Manolo Betancourt's specialty tres leches cakes, breads, and pastries. It's a great place to buy sweets and simultaneously support his, quote, purpose-driven brand, end quote, that champions social action through his nonprofit. By Immigration Hands, Betancourt's newest spot, the Change Baker Place, brought Colombian espresso, gelato, and pastries to East Charlotte in early 2026. One of the city's most vibrant spots to grab a bite is Optimist Hall, a 1892 textile mill became Charlotte's first food hall in 2019, anchoring a new district between Noda and Uptown. 25 stalls run the cuisine gamut from Ethiopian dishes to barbecue to wood-fired pizzas to Jewish deli sandwiches to tacos. Merwan Irani's Indian street food concept, Botiwala, has an outpost here. It's one of three places in town to get Chef Huynh Zhang's acclaimed Sichuan dumplings and noodles. What started as a pop-up at neighborhood karaoke night turned into a food truck with a cult following and eventually three locations of the Dumpling Lady. Each serves Zhang's original recipe using high-quality ingredients from both local purveyors and her hometown in China. I wanted to break down people's stereotypes because they think Chinese food is always made with cheap ingredients, she says. But we use good ingredients, source everything intentionally, and make all of the dumplings by hand. Leveling up, the best thing about Charlotte's food scene is how it challenges and reinvents itself with every new opening. Chef Sam Hart earned the city's sole Michelin star for his immersive tasting menu experience at Counter. His restaurant group's newest spot, Spaghetti, brings a comfortable vibe with an Italian-inspired four-course prefix menu in a former home built in the 1800s. In another landmark opening for Uptown, acclaimed area chef Joe Kindred, known for Kindred and Milk Bread in nearby Davidson, debuted Albertine in the heart of the financial district in late 2024. Elegant marble tables and rich velvet banquettes set the scene for an inventive menu that fuses Mediterranean and Southern flavors in dishes like pickle brined South Carolina quail with Aleppo pepper, hot honey, and cucumber labneh. You might not expect to find world-class sushi in landlocked Charlotte, but Robin Anthony, who was named a James Beard Award semifinalist for Best Chef Southeast this year, doesn't let geography get in his way. At his three prime fish restaurants, he prepares traditional edamame-style sushi with fish flown in from around the world. If you don't snag a chair at his Michelin-recommended six-seat omakase experience, stop into one of his two other locations where you can order a la carte nigiri and sashimi or do a chef's choice mini tasting. Charlotte's culinary culture is so rich and multifaceted that it's difficult to define, but La Ostrica takes a shot at summarizing. The restaurant showcases the seasonal bounty of the Carolina Piedmont while utilizing global flavors. The food is serious and creative, but served without pretense. They're redefining how you act as a fine dining tasting menu restaurant, says Johnson about owners Eric Ferguson and Kat Carter. They are so homey and kind, and you feel so relaxed and not stuffy. The multi-course meal is a collaboration between head chef Ferguson, Carter, who also handles wine pairings, and the rest of the staff. Dishes might include sugar-smoked duck or lamb milanese with dark chocolate demi-glace. An a la carte menu is offered at the bar. During the day, they serve as a wine shop and cafe. Sunday nights are reserved for casual-themed dinners. In about 2 years, they've made quite a splash, earning regional awards for Best New Restaurant. Despite the reception, Ferguson still sees work to be done, and that's part of the fun. The culinary scene here is sort of in its adolescent stages, he notes. It's an exciting time to be in Charlotte with food because it's growing and the people are growing with it. End of story. You are listening to Southern Living Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer broadcaster, Leslie Hunt. Continuing on, our next article is entitled Her Forever Cottage: Why Designer Ann Pulliam Fell Head Over Heels for This Quirky Richmond, Virginia Haven. This was written by Betsy Watson. The entry: there isn't a true foyer, so the family treats the sitting room by the front door as their drop zone. Wall hooks catch sun hats or coats depending on the season, and the vintage Ushak rug hides stains with its existing patina. We don't have a lot of storage, so I have Pottery Barn baskets scattered everywhere, says Anne, who uses one to corral shoes. It took designer Anne Pulliam 2 seconds flat to fall hook, line, and sinker for her family's 1935 Cape Cod-style house. The moment we walked in, we saw these old random-width pine floors, and the living room had 11-foot-high ceilings. I was immediately in love, she says. I was like, this is it, 100%. Even though it's slightly falling down, this is what we're going to do, and I'll work till the day I die to restore it and bring it back to life. But for the first 2.5 years of calling at home, she wanted to experience the quirky and compact space pretty much as it was calling on cheap and cheerful updates to make it practical for her young family until they could swing a more comprehensive overhaul. One thing she learned, I love the feeling of a smaller home. It allows for a cozier atmosphere, she says. As a result, she's been focusing their ongoing renovation efforts on a big screened porch, a reimagined primary suite, and intentional cabinetry rather than expanding the volume in a major way. A lot of times people feel the need to add so much square footage or build a gigantic house, she notes. That's where I think you lose the character and the warmth. Here's how Anne packed her cottage's petite footprint with plenty of personality and functionality. The living room. In my house, there's a lot of color, but the walls are white because I like to use them as a backdrop for my art collection, says the designer, whose go-to shade is Benjamin Moore's White Heron, OC 57. This is especially true in the living room, where a piece by South Carolina artist Fletcher Williams III holds court over a Coley home sofa, a pair of vintage Louis Philippe chairs, and two Italian mid-century modern ones. That tension is what makes a room really interesting to me, she says. The dining room. Italian chairs dressed in bold chartreuse velvet surround the marble-top tulip table. People can be scared to put velvet on things, but it actually has inherent stain-resistant properties, says Anne, who has a trick for making the area live larger when entertaining, too. We only have room for 4 people at our dining table, so I've got these cocktail tables that pull up for 4 more. She uses an antique church pew for additional seating. A flat weave floor covering from Lily Cat Rugs in Birmingham anchors the space. The kitchen. The designer left the little nook largely untouched, embracing the original butter-yellow cabinets, save for the hardware, which she swapped for brass knobs from Rejuvenation. This kitchen feels tiny, but it is so functional because everything is within arm's reach, notes Anne, who ditched any tools and appliances that weren't used regularly. She hid the vinyl flooring with a sisal rug from Wayfair and hung a Roman shade in Odaline's Indian Checks fabric for extra spunk. For her children's playful retreat, she landed on a two-tone paint job, Benjamin Moore's White Heron, OC 57, and a color match to Farrow and Ball's De Nemis, number 299, as a cost-effective alternative to wallpaper. If it's above 55 degrees, we are outside and eating on that back patio, and the kids are running around, per Anne Pulliam. End of story. On to the at-home section, The Grumpy Gardener. This was written by Steve Bender. Dear Grumpy, why are flowers so hard to grow? Everything I plant looks terrible. Felicia. At the risk of sounding grumpy, oh, what the heck, I'll ask you some questions. Do you ever water your flowers? If not, you should. They all need moisture, and some require more than others. Shriveled blooms look terrible. Do you give them the right amount of light? You should. Some like sun. Some prefer shade. If you plant sun lovers in the shadows, they'll look terrible. What's the soil like? Is it loose, well-drained, and rich in organic matter? That's good. Or is it chock full of broken asphalt, rusty nails, and plastic bags? That's terrible. Do you pick options that grow well in your area? If you live in Manitoba and plant peonies, they'll do great. If you're located in Corpus Christi, Texas, and choose lupines, they'll look terrible. Finally, where do you get your gardening advice? If it's from me, that's smart. If it's from sketchy internet posts with headlines like, "Seven flowers that all pigeons fear," that's terrible. Pitiful peonies. What could be wrong with my peonies? The buds dry up and don't open. Some of the stems have wilted and fallen over. Charlotte. This sounds like the handiwork of a fungus called Botrytis blight. Its spores overwinter in plant debris and infect new peony shoots as they pop up from the ground in spring. Once symptoms appear, the bloom season is ruined, and your attention must turn to preventing a repeat performance the following year. To do this, cut all their foliage to the ground every fall and throw it out with the trash. Next, spray your peonies in spring according to the label directions with a fungicide called Daconil. Apply it to new shoots just as they emerge, and then repeat every 2 weeks until June. Finally, mulch beneath your peonies in spring to cover up any spores on the ground. Save this note. Getting cheeky. I came across an advert for a hummingbird flower called Kiss Me Over the Garden Gate. I had never heard of it and am concerned it might be an invasive non-native species more deserving of the name Spank Me Over the Garden Rail. Sorry, I had to do that. What say you, Tom? Kiss Me Over the Garden Gate, Persicaria orientalis, is an old-fashioned pass-along plant favored by Thomas Jefferson and friends in Virginia. Although not native to the U.S., it hails from eastern Russia and Asia. It is not horribly invasive like other members of its genus. This tall, upright annual grows 4 to 5 feet in height from seeds produced by long, pendant red flowers. Seedlings don't transplant well, so they must be sown in place outdoors, preferably near a garden gate where they will provide a spanking good show. Leggy Rhodi. Our rhododendron has gotten really tall and leggy. How do we trim it back without killing it? When is a good time to do this? Michelle. It's always a good time not to kill something, Michelle, with the exception of cockroaches, feral hogs, fire ants, and accordion players. I'm just kidding about that last one. Squeeze box musicians are shamefully underappreciated, and I will not rest until one is finally inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. That goes double for Styx and Jethro Tull. Prune your rhododendron right after it finishes blooming. Use shears or loppers, not hedge trimmers. Cut back any wayward or too tall stems to the points where they join with others below them. Don't just create leafless stubs. End of story. Ask the Grump. No question goes unanswered on his Facebook page at facebook.com/SL Grumpy, G-R-U-M-P-Y, Gardener. Grumpy's Gripe of the Month. Most popular DIY solutions to everyday garden problems share two things. First, they're free or really, really cheap. Second, they require scant research, expertise, time, and effort. So it is with the miraculous insecticide called, quote, boiling water, end quote. How many of you dispatch fire ants by pouring scalding water on the mounds? I understand the appeal. Everyone I know has a stove, a pot, and water to boil. But this seldom succeeds. If you don't kill the queens deep below ground, they just lay more eggs and the mounds return. Plus, you end up emoliating earthworms, beneficial soil microbes, and the surrounding grass. Tell the truth. The real reason you do this is not because you think it works, but because ants stung you and you want payback. Tisk, tisk. Haven't you heard? Vengeance is a dish best served cold. Know your plants, Chinese snowball. There's nothing subtle about this shrub. When spring rolls around, brace for impact. Go big or go home is the motto of Chinese snowball. Viburnum macrocephalum. Spectacular rounded flower clusters up to 8 inches wide adorn its branches in April and May. The blooms open a striking lime green and then quickly brighten to pure white. No one can miss the gaudy show. As an added bonus, the leaves turn burgundy in the fall. This large, face-shaped, deciduous shrub grows 8 to 15 feet tall and wide. So give it some room. Use it as a seasonal accent or plant a row for an informal screen. It needs no pampering. Just provide full to partial sun and moist, well-drained soil. Do any necessary pruning soon after its flowers fade in early summer. You can grow Chinese snowball in USDA zones 6B through 9. End of story. Well, that wraps it up for today's Sun Living Magazine. This is Leslie Hunt, your volunteer broadcast. Stay tuned for the East Valley News for Queen Creek and Santan Valley coming up next on Sun Sounds of Arizona.